Welcome to Bright Videos News for Thursday, July 23rd, 2026. I'm Mike Adams. Thank you for joining me. And the focus here today is to disabuse you of an assumption that we've all made, and we've all made the same mistake by carrying this assumption. The assumption is that the Strait of Hormuz will eventually reopen. And I've made that assumption. I've made that mistake. I've said it many times. I've said, well, you know, for example, industrial use of silver will be restored once the strait is reopened, right? Once the energy flows, return to normal. And by normal, we're talking about essentially the year 2025. And for a while, I suppose this was not an irrational piece of hopium or anything. It was it was critical thinking, but also believing that there would be such strong incentives for the Strait of Hormuz to reopen that the players would find a way. You know, the Saudis, for example, their entire kingdom depends on essentially the Strait of Hormuz being open. And if you don't believe me, just ask the Houthis, who have set fire to two Saudi tankers in the Red Sea over the last day or so. Yeah, tankers burning in the Red Sea, not a good sign for the Saudi kingdom. But also, think about all the other Persian Gulf states or the GCC nations there, Kuwait, Bahrain, UAE, etc. They have a strong incentive, obviously, for the strait to reopen. And so does the United States, because the U.S. economy depends on so many things that come out of the Persian Gulf, including helium and polyethylene and sulfur / sulfuric acid, and also oil. You know, for example, I mean, the U.S. does import oil, 6.5 million barrels per day. And although it doesn't import directly from the Middle East very much, there is, you know, oil is a global commodity at different grades. And so any lack of oil affects the ability of the U.S. to find affordable supplies. That's why oil is going to surpass $150 a barrel. That's coming. And that may be just the beginning. So anyway, I had assumed, and probably you had assumed, that there would be strong incentives to finish this, or, you know, leave, or find a way to get to peace, etc. Because also, think about what this is doing politically to the GOP in the United States as gas prices continue to rise and diesel rationing is in our near future, by the way. And what's that going to do to food prices, since diesel fuel transports almost everything? I think you get the picture. You know, the U.S. doesn't benefit from a prolonged war, that's for sure. And really, neither does anybody else. However, we made a mistake with that assumption. And, you know, I made the same mistake. The mistake is in thinking that the people in charge of the world want the world to work for humans. And that's a huge error. And as we're finding out, it's simply not the case. They don't want the world to work. They do want a breakdown of the systems that keep 8 billion human beings alive. And so what we need to do is to upgrade our understanding of this scenario to the point where we realize that the Strait of Hormuz, let me back up, that the Persian Gulf region, its exports will never, never return to what we had in 2025. Now, maybe the Strait of Hormuz will be opened at some point, no doubt under the control of Iran, but many of the nations in the region will be so wrecked with so much destruction of their infrastructure that they won't be able to resume exports probably ever. And, you know, this actually came up as a discussion in my recent interview with Matt Bracken and Michael Yon. I ran that interview yesterday. If you missed it, it is a must listen interview. I've had so much positive feedback about that. And some people were really frightened by the interview. And they asked me, like, were you scared? Were you afraid when you heard their answers? No. No. What Why would I be afraid? I already assume that there's an effort. I mean, I gave a speech in 2019 about the effort to prepare Earth for a post-human future. Okay, so none of this is new to me. I've been expecting this for a long time. I just didn't realize that this was the way they were going to do it. Now it's becoming more obvious, as Matt Bracken pointed out. If the water desalination plants are destroyed across the region, which are, of course, critical for supporting human populations there, then you got nothing. Then it's not even survivable. And even worse, now, this was something that surprised me, came up in the interview. Even worse, there's no way to evacuate the millions of people who live in the region. You know, a few can get out, like some in Iraq can go north or whatever. But a lot of the populations in the other countries, especially, I would say, UAE in particular, Bahrain, not looking good. They don't have any way to get out. I mean, think about it. You can't get out by sea because the strait is blocked. You can't get out by air because the airports are mostly not functioning and it's not safe. I mean, I guess sometimes the airports are open, but often not. You can't get out by road. That's not safe. And if there's no water, there's probably no electricity as well. And so if you have no water, no electricity, you have no air conditioning. And so you die in 120 degree Fahrenheit desert heat with no water and no way out. And we could literally see a scenario where some massive number, I don't know, millions potentially of people die in the region because they can't get out. Now, I hope that doesn't happen. But, you know, Trump keeps promising to escalate and Iran is promising to retaliate. And, you know, the escalation ladder leads very quickly to Trump bombing Iran's power plants and Iran bombing the region's water desalination plants. And by the way, just as a quick note, desalination is the correct pronunciation of that term. I hear a lot of people say desalinization, which is they're adding an extra syllable. So just want to let you know that the correct way is desalination. Just look at the way the word is spelled and you can see that's the correct way. Anyway, sorry, my editor hat, I'll take it off now and I will continue. But I'll just say this. I was really happy when I heard a report from Dr. Chris Martinson and he pronounced it correctly, desalination, which I would expect from Dr. Chris Martinson because he is a detailed-minded and very accurate researcher. So anyway, he nailed it, but not everybody's getting that right. Anyway, what happens if the population collapses around the Persian Gulf states there, the GCC? What happens then? How do you go back in and rebuild infrastructure? Let's say in Qatar. You know, Qatar is a nation that is, well, a kingdom that is highly vulnerable to all these things I'm talking about here. And if the gas infrastructure goes down, we've talked about this before, it will take 10 years to bring it back online if all 14 gas trains are damaged or destroyed, okay? A decade to bring it back online. But before you could even attempt to do that, you'd have to bring the water desalination plants back online because you have to have water to send in crews to rebuild the gas trains. But before you can bring the water back online, you have to have the power grid back online because the water desalination plants use a tremendous amount of power, of course. So how do you provide the water and the air conditioning and the food to the crews that are rebuilding the power plants when nothing else works? Yeah, it's almost like trying to build like a moon base or something, you know? How do you send astronauts to the moon and build a moon base? Well, it's not easy. You notice it hasn't been done. Well, there's no moon bases on the moon. You know, at best, if you believe NASA, we just left behind a bunch of junk, you know, a bunch of stuff. It was too heavy to blast off with. Just left it there. Probably that lunar rover, too, which seemed to magically change itself every time there was another mission. I don't know. Plus, seasonally, you can't live in the Middle East without air conditioning and, you know, obviously lots of power and lots of water, because it's so freaking hot that people die if they try to live there or try to travel through there. It's very, very hot. So my point is, if this war escalates even just a little bit more, we could permanently lose the Persian Gulf. And what if there's a nuclear war, for example? What if there's radioactive fallout in the region and it becomes uninhabitable for 300 years because of cesium-137, right? So as you ponder this, you begin to get the picture of really where this is going. We are about to cross the threshold at which there is no restoration of the GCC nations, or I should say the output from those nations that our world has grown accustomed to. And as I've explained previously, look, if you lose 10% of the total world fertilizer production, you're going to lose about 5% of the world's population, because about half the world is kept alive through, you know, fertilizer created, mostly nitrogen fertilizers. If you lose 20 million barrels of oil a day from the global marketplace, then you're going to have a contraction of GDP all around the world. You're going to have a contraction as ultimately oil prices will have to skyrocket, because you can't just keep releasing all the strategic reserves forever. They're running out. They're almost out now, just like a couple of months left, maybe, and that's it. So oil prices are going to skyrocket, and then that's going to cause actually a global depression, joblessness, you know, price inflation among consumer goods, probably fuel rationing and scarcity, maybe leading to political revolt, social revolutions, civil unrest around the world, as prices rise and people can't afford to eat. So instead of you and I hoping and thinking that the war is going to end and we're going to get back to normal, and maybe within a year, normal energy flows will resume and, you know, gas will be cheap again and natural gas will be readily available, etc., it's time for us to recalibrate our understanding of where this is going, which is probably the Persian Gulf is never coming back online at the capacity that it used to achieve. Now, I have no doubt that there will be some exports out of the region, some oil, you know, some gas, some sulfuric acid pulled out of the oil, you know, the sulfur, but probably nowhere near the 100 up to 120 tankers per day. Nowhere near what we used to see. As a result, then, the world will contract. Economies will shrink. Populations will shrink. The world will... It will go backwards in terms of progress. You know, it's going to go backwards. We're going to lose progress in our world, and we're going to lose GDP growth. And we're going to lose probably hundreds of millions of people. All right? So that's the scenario that I am now planning for. It's an assumption, sure, but it's an assumption that's now rooted in a rational assessment of the absolute irrational lunacy of Trump and the Pentagon and Israel and the West and clearly the globalists, who do not want peace. They do not want 8 billion human beings to be able to support themselves with food or energy or industry or jobs or whatever. They are using war in the Middle East as the first domino to fall to lead to some level of global depopulation and rapid economic contraction. Okay, so that's where we are. In other words, this is like COVID, but bigger. Much larger impact. And that's why, you know, you listen to Trump or Hegseth and or these war generals, they all sound insane. They're like, we can't trust Iran, you know, or what do they say? Iran. We can't trust Iran. They never keep their word. they're untrustworthy. You know, as this pure projection, it's the United States that's constantly lying, constantly betraying, constantly assassinating negotiators, constantly escalating. Well, that's on purpose. Okay. It's not an accident. Trump is just a puppet, as Michael Yon said in the interview the other day. Trump's not in control. The globalists are in control. And they're going to keep this war going. And now we even had a guest, you know, like a pro-Trump guest on Fox News, that said this might be a 20-year war. And Trump himself is now comparing this to the duration to Vietnam, which he claims was a 19-year war, which, of course, makes you wonder about Trump's mastery of integers. But you get the idea. So they're starting to reframe this as something, you know, it used to be like, what, it was going to be 2 to 3 weeks, or it's going to be 30 days, and this is going to be done. Or at the beginning, it was a weekend, right? This is going to be like Venezuela. It's going to be 3 days, and we're done. Now they're telling you, it might be 20 years. Yeah. And during that 20 years, do you think the Strait of Hormuz is going to be fully functioning? No. Uh-uh. And that's on purpose. This is a potentially a 20-year stranglehold on the human race to just kill off as many people as possible through mass famine and economic collapse, industrial collapse. Basically, you know, an engineered energy shock. So this is the civilizational reset that I've been warning about. It's here. And once you understand that, then it changes how you plan for what's coming. Because then you stop thinking about, oh, how do I make it through until the war is over? I think that's going to be like 30 more days. Instead of that, you start thinking, how do I restructure my life to survive the end of civilization as we know it? Because that's where we are. And that's a, you know, that's a much bigger challenge. Now, you may recall, I wrote a book and published it for free. You can download it. Well, it's actually a series of podcasts, but it was also made into a book. It's called Resilient Prepping. And I think the website is still up. It's resilientprepping.com. And there you can download the book, all the PDF files, the transcripts, and the audio. And what Resilient Prepping teaches you for free is how to prepare to survive the loss of the power grid, the loss of combustion engines, that is, you know, diesel and gasoline, and how to live in a low-tech but sustainable manner that can still keep you alive. That book covers those scenarios for all the key areas of survival, from shelter and food and, you know, self-defense, emergency medicine, everything. So that book is actually more useful now than when I first, you know, recorded all the audio on that. And again, it's free to download, so enjoy that. I should probably update that book, come to think of it, and put out a new version. Resilient Prepping 2027, you know, how to not die from, you know, from the globalist war on humanity, something like that. Maybe I will update it. In any case, check out that book. Also, get prepared in every way you can. You know about all of our long-term storable organic lab-tested food supplies at healthrangerstore.com. But did you know about the satellite phones and the Faraday bags at sat123.com? sat123.com. That's our sponsor, by the way. And are you looking into solar? Any kind of solar solutions? Because that's what I'm building right now, and I'm very close to filming some new videos on that to show you what's happening. I certainly have paid the price in terms of having all the blisters from crimping and attaching a bunch of MC4 connectors and pulling wire through conduit and everything else that goes along with building PV systems. I've paid the dues on that, so I'll be bringing you those videos pretty soon. And of course, we'll continue to talk about food self-reliance and natural medicine and so much more, because that's going to be critical for staying alive. So anyway, you can follow my work at naturalnews.com, and you can follow my podcast at brightvideos.com. And you can follow me on social media at Health Ranger. That's my call sign on X, and also brighteon.social. On Telegram, I'm Real Health Ranger. Don't fall for the imposters there on Telegram who want you to buy their crypto, and they pretend to be me, but no, I would not be hyping crypto on Telegram, that's for sure. So just be cautious and stay informed. I'll bring you more information every single day and more powerful interviews. And by the way, if you missed my interview with Michael Yan and Matt Bracken, definitely go back and check it, because it's on brightvideos.com. You don't want to miss it. It's a big deal. And also, come to think of it, our DTV interview with Andy Scheckman, talking about China's gold plans and the Shanghai Gold Exchange and the plans of what's happening in Hong Kong with gold storage, getting ready for the ending of paper markets, or the paper leverage on gold and silver that China has put into play for retail investors beginning tomorrow, actually. Yeah, that begins tomorrow. That's interesting. So definitely check that out. That's at decentralized.tv. You don't want to miss that one either. So watch all the videos I put out if you can. I mean, if you have time, or at least some of the higher end interviews if your time is limited, and stay informed. And I will do my best to keep you informed, aware, alive through all of this. This is going to be challenging. If the Strait of Hormuz, or let's say if the Persian Gulf does not come back online, our world is so absolutely screwed, and almost nobody realizes it. Almost no one. They have no idea the catastrophe, the collapse that's coming. And in some places, Mad Max. Not everywhere, but some places, yes. Okay, so stay informed and enjoy the rest of today's broadcast. I caught a post about a video segment on X where Professor Steve Keen was talking about the risk of a global die-off based on the destruction of food infrastructure. And I swear, I'm like, is this dude, like, did he just read my article? Because he is saying exactly what I have laid out with receipts and with research. I mean, he's quoting the Haber-Bosch process. You know, he's talking about how there will have to be equilibrium reached between the available food infrastructure. He's talking about how the available food infrastructure, as it contracts, the global population that can be supported will also sharply contract. And I was thinking, man, this is really something. Now, just to be clear, I'm not accusing Professor Steve Keen of plagiarizing my content. What I'm pointing out here is something even more interesting, which is that he and I, who have never spoken before, by the way, we have arrived at the exact same conclusion independently. And he's a famous economist, you know, and I'm a food science guy, and we both followed the same logic, the same evidence. And also, you know, with my friend Michael Yan, who has been warning about famine for a very long time. And of course, I interview Michael Yan on a regular basis. But we arrived at the exact same conclusion completely independently. So it's actually, I encourage you to listen to Steve Keen explain this, because it's good to hear what I've said explained by another person in a slightly different way, but very much the same, you know, the same numbers, same conclusion. Steve Keen says that 2 billion people are at risk of famine on our planet. And I was talking about very much the same concept, except I did the math and I came to the conclusion that it's really about 5% of the global population that is at risk, which is about 400 million people. So my numbers are actually smaller than his, but that's because I did a lot of research about the actual percentage of global fertilizer that comes out of the Persian Gulf. And when you do the research on that, you find out that it's really only about 10% of the global fertilizer comes out of the Persian Gulf, even though it's more than 30% of the traded fertilizer. So that's what sometimes confuses people, It's 30% of the fertilizer that is bought and sold, but it's only 10% of the fertilizer that's produced globally, because many countries produce and consume their own fertilizer domestically, such as, well, you know, Russia, for example, and to some extent, the U.S., China, Canada, etc. So 10%. So what is, well, and then the Haber-Bosch process, understand, feeds about half the world's population. So that's 4 billion people. So what is 10% of 4 billion? That is 400 million people. So that's why I'm saying 400 million, which is about 5% of the total global population of 8 billion, 400 million is the accurate number, at least in my research, of how many people are at risk of famine due to this ongoing closure of the Strait of Hormuz. It's 400 million. But I also want to be clear that it's not just an actual list of 400 million people who will just drop over dead tomorrow, because that's not the way food distribution actually works in the real world. So as I said in my podcast, it's 400 million human equivalent units per day who are not getting food in 2027 and 2028 because of the long delay time from fertilizer. And I didn't hear Professor Keane describe it in that way. I think my research has gone, you know, maybe I dug a little bit deeper into the numbers on that. But the overall emphasis of what Steve Keen is saying is very much aligned with what I'm saying. We have slightly different numbers of who's impacted or how many are impacted. But the truth is, for every day that the Strait is closed down, there are essentially 400 million equivalent human units of people who do not have food. Not today, though. I'm talking about 2027. That's what's critical to understand. Now, as I also explained, there will be some redistribution of food. There will be some substitutions. You know, there can be a lot of efforts where one person who's starving in a city, you know, other people around that person are sharing food. I mean, this is how it's actually going to happen. There will be more redistribution. So the pressure of food scarcity will be shared by everyone in a nation like Bangladesh, or almost everyone, certainly the lower income class people, the poor and the middle class people will all suffer some exposure to food scarcity, whereas the wealthy will be able to just buy their way out of it by paying, you know, any price for food. But that's not most people. Most people are not going to be able to buy their way out of this. And so people will starve. So anyway, Professor Steve Keen is an interesting person. I think he's right on about most issues when it comes to economics, fiscal policy, currency, and so on, and debt. He talks a lot about debt markets, at least in the interviews I've seen. But he still believes in climate change. And I've always been struck by the fact that there are very smart, well-informed people who still think that carbon dioxide is bad for planet Earth somehow, because it doesn't make any rational sense at all. Although we've seen this again and again. And, you know, Professor Keen is convinced that climate change is going to be catastrophic and, you know, all the typical climate alarmism propaganda. He believes all that stuff. And I guess I have to give him a pass on that, because he's an economist and he's not a chemist. He doesn't know about atmospheric chemistry, and he doesn't probably understand, you know, photosynthesis and where food comes from, because that's not his focus. But that's my focus. I mean, I'm a food scientist, and that's why I've been talking about the total hoax of climate change for many, many years. And for me, that's a litmus test of intelligence. If somebody thinks that carbon dioxide is bad for Earth, then I can never consider them to be very smart. Because if you can't understand the fundamental concept of CO2 as one of the key inputs for photosynthesis, then, you know, come on, you're just not that bright. And there's a lot of experts in many areas. There's physicists who believe in climate change, you know. there's economists, there are, you know, lots of doctors and surgeons, you know, like actual brain surgeons who believe in climate change. And it's because they are indoctrinated and they don't exercise any kind of critical, rational thinking. Nevertheless, not everybody is up to speed on every area of knowledge, it turns out. And I don't claim to know everything either, but I think I understand the broad strokes of these really critical issues, you know, energy versus climate, etc. You know, photosynthesis, agriculture, crop production, plants, you know, nutritional density, which is actually improved by higher levels of CO2 in the atmosphere, things like that. But I don't know everything either. So it's important that you and I learn from people in their areas of expertise. You know, we can learn something from lots of people, even if they don't have a complete big picture of everything that's going on. It's fine. It's okay. Everybody doesn't have to know everything, right? So we can still learn from people. So with that said, definitely check out other experts who are talking about famine. And I'm going to be interviewing Michael Yan coming up. And he's also another one who has traveled the world. He's witnessed this firsthand. He knows what's happening. And he's a very valued voice in this space. And I've learned a lot from Michael Yan as well. And there's Matt Bracken. I've got Matt Bracken coming up for an interview as well. You know, former Navy SEAL, who is an excellent researcher, writer, author of many books. So I'll try to bring you the best information I can, and I'll work to connect you with as many experts as I can, and we'll just take it from there. In the meantime, because of what's happening with energy and with food, you should get as self-reliant as possible. You should think about erecting solar installations so you can charge your own car with sunlight. No joke. And you're going to need a quite a lot of solar panels to do that. Probably going to need about a minimum of 10 to 12 300 watt panels in order to keep your car charged. You know, just saying, it's not like I'm going to put out one panel and charge my car. It doesn't work that way. That's not enough juice. So you're going to need more panels, and you know, you might have to go out and buy a Tesla or some other EV that you want. Hyundai makes EVs. I think even Chevy is bringing some back. Ford makes EVs, but they suck. I wouldn't recommend anything from Ford. You know, get more self-reliant, grow more of your own food, plant your own herbs, make your own medicine. You know, obviously get more self-reliant because of what's coming. And if you want stored food that's lab tested and certified organic, you know, because I run a mass spec laboratory and we test for, you know, glyphosate and heavy metals and now dioxins and atrazine on some foods, certain crops and so on, you can buy ultra clean food from us packaged for long-term storage at healthrangerstore.com. And if you want other equipment such as solar generators or satellite phones, then our sponsor is the Satellite Phone Store at sat123.com. That's sat123.com. So check them out if they can help you. So thank you for listening, and you can catch more of my podcasts at brightvideos.com, and my articles are found at naturalnews.com. All right, everybody, be well and take care.
Initially, there were barely a handful of people around the world who were prepared to discuss this vexed issue of vaccine safety and autism causation. The parents will say, no, we don't trust you anymore. You have deceived us. You have betrayed our trust, and we will not be following your recommendations. The authorities only have themselves to blame for that, for attriting the trust of the public in public health diktat.
Welcome to today's interview here on brightvideos.com. I'm Mike Adams, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, one of my favorite people who has been a longtime champion of truth and freedom and inspiration for humanity, so much more. It's Andy Wakefield. Welcome, Andy. It's just an honor to have you on the show today.
Mike, it's always great to see you. Great to be back.
Well, it's again, I'm honored to have you on, and I understand that you have just published a new book, and I wanted to get you on to talk about that book because it's something very different from the normal books, isn't it? I mean, tell us about it.
Very different, yes. It's a fictional story, but based on a true story, and that true story is fascinating in itself. Many years ago, about 2010, I was giving a lecture at a conference on autism in the US. And that night, a mother who had helped organize the conference, a mother of a single, profoundly autistic teenager, nonverbal, regressed the very day that he received his MMR vaccine. She took me out for dinner. And she asked me over dinner if I would father a child for her. Now, you may think, what a very strange thing to bring up on Mike's show. But her motives were most sincere. She wasn't interested in a night of passion with Andy Wakefield. What she wanted was to conceive and to have a child who was healthy and who could go on to care for her older boy when she was either infirm or no longer around. Once she'd passed. And this is a nightmare that confronts millions of parents across this country and around the world every day. What happens when we are no longer here to look after them because the world does not understand them, does not care about them, and most certainly doesn't love them in the way that we do. And it is a massive contingent, brother. There are 9 million families at least in this country who share this concern every single day. And so I was so inspired by her request that I said, I'm going to write a screenplay about this. And I did. And I wrote it, and I set it in the West. It's a Western, 1886, on the Oregon Trail. And it's a pioneer family who encounter a Native American Indian attack and historically many of these things are accurate. They are based in truth, and they're wiped out. They're wiped out to a man and a woman apart from two people, and that is one woman, Nia, and her autistic son. And it's about survival in one of the most brutal environments in the world. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to take it away from the thorny issue of causation, because I wanted to focus specifically on this issue, this question, what happens when I am no longer around? What happens to my child? And the second is to set it in a brutal, harsh environment of freezing cold and starvation and disease and disbelief and prejudice and all these things that really accumulate to test this woman's metal. And it is a story that then, as a film, I'll wrap up on this. You put these things on the shelf, Mike. You come back to them a few years later. You think, I'll make some changes and update it. And I came back to this, and I thought, now's the time to make a film. And my assistant said to me, no, what you should do is write a book and get some attention for it. Much cheaper to write a book than it is to make a movie. And someone will look at this and say, wow, this would make a great film. Let's take it from here. And so that's what I did. And it was released on the 26th of last month. And it is now on the Amazon bestseller list and doing very well.
Wow. Wow. All right. So the website for the book is called thebequest.co. And just want to remind our audience, it's not .com, it's .co. So thebequest.co, and that's the title of the book, The Bequest, Andrew J. Wakefield, the winter of 1867. Wow. So Andy, you know, you're quite an accomplished filmmaker in your own right with the documentary projects that you've done and produced. And I'm just so impressed with the energy and creativity that you have. I also know that you don't tackle a project lightly. So I would imagine that you must have done a lot of period research for this in order to make it accurate for 1867. Is that a safe assumption?
Yes, it is. And I enjoy that enormously. Being an academic, a little bit of a boff, I love going into these things in some detail and pulling out factual elements pertaining, in this case, to the town of Laramie and the formation of Laramie before the railroad reached there, just before it reached, and everything that went with that frontier town, the difficulties, the harshness, the enterprise, the enthusiasm, the death, and whatever. It was such fun to put it together and take it away again from the thing I've been dealing with for 30 years, and that is the harsh reality of autism and vaccine safety.
And I'm not trying to make light of the hardship of that period. However, it's a different kind of brutal environment for parents today who have autistic children. And one of the things that happens, I think, in our modern world that perhaps didn't happen in the 19th century is that today, when a mother in particular realizes that vaccines were responsible for making her child autistic, then she is punished a second time by society for daring to suggest that there's a link between vaccines and autism. So
it's absolutely one of the greatest cruelties of really imaginable.
Right. So in some ways, you know, emotionally, psychologically, the environment today is, you know, more brutal than the Oregon Trail. Although I understand they're very different, but what I'm saying is that the emotional impact today can be just as tormenting.
Let me give you an example of that, Mike, and that is a woman who is currently in the news and has been on Children's Health Defense, a mother whose two twins died shortly after a vaccine. And I tell you this as I understand it from the facts that I've read. And she blamed the vaccines. And because she blamed the vaccines and because she is part of a case being brought against the vaccine industry, they've come after her for murder, double murder of those twins. So, I mean, and this is extraordinary that I don't know all the details of this case, but I do know how the system operates. And if you call into question the safety of vaccines, if you blame vaccines, and sudden infant death syndrome would be a major problem for the manufacturers and the regulators, that they will come after you and they will stop at nothing. And it doesn't matter that you've already suffered the loss of two infant children, that they're going to come after you and potentially face the death sentence for something that I really, 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 in my experience, which of the last 30 years, she is not guilty. So it is, you're right, it is a very, very cruel world in which we currently operate. And it seems to be geared in very much in favor of the profiteering of the pharmaceutical companies and how to deal with threats that they encounter.
Yeah, clearly, I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because, you know, SIDS, which I call sudden immunization death syndrome, is it's clear, right? The causality is established through the statistical analysis of the very short lag time between the vaccine and the death of the infants, and repeatedly across, you know, thousands of documented cases. So yet we live in a world of absolute denial by the industry that profits from these practices. And even like you just said, blaming parents. And Andy, I believe that there's progress being made in terms of public awareness of this, especially since COVID. So in the last 6 years, roughly, there's a lot more awareness, but still to this day, infants are being either killed or made instantly autistic. It continues to this day, this horrific crime against humanity. How much more has to happen before we can stop this barbaric practice?
I should say, I mean, an example of this is I was reading Cassidy, Senator Cassidy, the other day, where he pronounced unambiguously that there was an abundance of science that proved vaccines did not cause autism, and that anyone who suggested they did really was almost evil. And that's what we face at the sort of highest political level in among the people who have the microphone in front of them and the ears of the media. This mother clearly doesn't have the ears of the media except to, you know, to condemn her outright. Now, the problem with Cassidy is he's clearly not aware. He's operating from a position of ignorance, and that is a very dangerous position, because Nick Hulsher and Peter McCullough have just published a paper which analyzed all 136 studies that have looked at or purported to look at the vaccine autism link that have been published, including 12 comparisons of health outcomes in fully vaccinated children compared with unvaccinated children. And they show unambiguously and conclude that early childhood vaccines and multiple childhood vaccines are the single most modifiable risk factor, and the single most important modifiable risk factor for autism spectrum disorder. In other words, it's preventable. They are the single most important modifiable risk factor. They are the environmental cause. So Cassidy clearly has not read this, and yet he's there pronouncing the safety of these vaccines and their lack of an association with autism while taking a great deal of money, I've no doubt, for his campaign.
Sure.
From the pharmaceutical industry. Fortunately, if that is the case, then those campaigns have been unsuccessful and he won't have another term in the Senate. So the ignorance persists. However, I am an optimist, and I come from a position where when I got involved initially, there were barely a handful of people around the world who were prepared to discuss this vexed issue of vaccine safety and autism causation. Now, given the people like you, people who've written the scientific papers, people who have made the movies, including Del Bigtree's latest compelling movie, An Inconvenient Study, and most importantly, COVID, people have really focused their attention on their trust in the health authorities, their trust in the pharmaceutical industry, the vaccine makers, and they have decided in many, many cases to not comply anymore, not go along with it. And in the end, Mike, the market wins. You know this, the market always wins. And the market is the consumer in this case being the parents. The parents will say, no, we don't trust you anymore. You have deceived us, you have betrayed our trust, and we will not be following your recommendations. And the authorities only have themselves to blame for that. Not you or I.
Right.
But they have themselves to blame for attriting the trust of the public in public health diktat.
Well, and I'm thinking of how many advocates for vaccine safety they have created with the toxic vaccines producing autistic children. You know, I'm thinking like attorney Brian Festa at We the Patriots is because of his son that he became, you know, informed on this issue, and he's become an advocate for health freedom. Let me go back to your book for a moment and ask you a question. Again, the book is called The Bequest, and it's out now. And I understand there's an Audible version out as well.
There is, came out today.
Oh wow! Okay, great timing. So.
Read folks, by me, Mike, I should say.
Oh,
I'm ashamed to say.
Even better. That's great.
My assistant once again suggested that I should read it, and so I did.
Well, that's fantastic. Okay, so The Bequest, a love story on the American frontier. Now, is it possible that then there would be a film to come out of this?
Absolutely essential, Mike. If you know Taylor Sheridan, or if you have any contact with Taylor Sheridan, this is something in the sort of genre of 1883. So please put me in touch with Taylor and let's get together. Taylor, give me a call. And Mike has my number. But yeah, I would. The film will be made. Many people read books, but many, many, many more watch movies. And so the movie, in order for this to have the impact that's necessary to get out there and enlighten the world, then it needs to be made into a movie.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, I really look forward to that. If that happens, that'd be amazing. You said it's in Laramie. So would you actually film it in Wyoming then or what?
Oh yeah. I'd love to.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. What a beautiful place to get to make this movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, Wyoming is beautiful country. And the mountains, I see on your book cover, you're showing some of the mountains there. Of course, the Yellowstone Park is right there, the northwest corner of the state. Also a beautiful country. You know, we have a lot to be thankful for in this country. And I've even said that, you know, there's so much natural abundance in the world that we can tap into. And most of the problems that are created in our society are actually man-made problems. And I think that autism is largely exactly that very thing. Without all this widespread toxic immunization that's pushed dishonestly, we wouldn't have all these cases of autism, it seems to me, and SIDS as well. So that's you know, it's an attack on humankind. It takes away the natural abundance that exists in our world.
It's absolutely tragic that it is so avoidable. And the problem, and this brings me to Adele's latest film, which, if you haven't seen it, if your audience haven't seen it, please, An Inconvenient Study. And they go to a rabidly pro-vaccine professor, doctor, up in Michigan, the Ford Health Clinic, Ford Health Center, and say, look, they sit down with him perfectly reasonably and say, you have a huge population of children with vaccine records, some vaccinated, some unvaccinated. Why don't, if vaccines are safe, conduct the study. Do the study comparing health outcomes in vaccinated and unvaccinated. And whatever the results, whether they support our position or your position, they should be published. And he agreed. He absolutely agreed to do it. And he did that study. And they went up and sat down with him again and said, why won't you publish it? Do you not believe it's a good? Yes, it's a perfectly good study. It was well conducted. The results are valid, but I'm not going to publish it because it's going to be the end of my career. So that man, who purports to be a scientist, a medical scientist, is prepared, it seems, to deny people the truth, deny them the facts, and put millions of children at continued risk of a serious permanent neurological condition and many other conditions.
And in order to protect his own interests, yeah.
To protect himself. And that, to me, is unbelievable for anyone.
Yeah.
To behave in that way. When your sworn duty is to protect the lives and health of the children of this country, to do that. Because I can tell you something, that Dell and Aaron Siri, who went to see him, they would have made sure it was published and widely broadcast if it had not supported their position.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have integrity.
Right.
Not so, it appears, with him.
Well, that's reflective of the entire vaccine industry. Intellectual dishonesty is the backbone of their whole system. Now, that actually leads me to the next question, which is that when Trump was elected and RFK Jr. was brought in as Secretary of HHS, there was a lot of optimism that perhaps he could find the traction to achieve quite a number of reforms in the vaccine schedule, in the leadership of CDC, FDA, et cetera. And now, despite many good faith efforts, it's very clear to me, but I'd love your comments on this, it's very clear to me that there is so much institutional momentum in the system and resistance against reform that it doesn't matter who you put in as HHS, the system itself, the system that pushes vaccines has its own bureaucratic immune system against change. And it will murder any effort to try to make things better for children. What are your comments?
You're absolutely right. I think Bobby's intentions were and remain of the highest integrity. I think the problem for him is, as you point out, on both sides of the aisle, you have a large number of politicians who are receiving funds from the pharmaceutical companies for their campaigns and are therefore somehow obliged to parrot the lies. And that is what has happened. So he has met enormous resistance. What he needs is at least another 4 years beyond the next nationwide election to allow him to continue his work. But it has characterized the sheer will of the system to preserve itself. And this is why it has to change from the bottom up, because we have learned from Bobby's experience that it will not change in anything like the right time frame from the top down. It has to change from the bottom up, where parents, now educated and willing, who've watched the movies, who've seen all of this play out, say no more.
That's it. And that's what's critical, happening. What you just said. Sorry to interrupt. There will be no top down change. So it is a waste of effort, in my opinion. You seem to be saying the same thing. It's a waste of effort to try to reform it from the top down. The real reform comes from
it does expose that agenda. So he's tried and tried and tried. And I'd be fascinated to talk to him once his term is complete.
Right.
To, you know, really document the resistance that he's met, but it has had a value in that sense. And I do believe
good point.
There will be some comparison of vaccinated, unvaccinated studies that emerge from the databases held closely to the chests of the federal agencies to this point. So I think the science is being done, and I think that we've yet to hear the whole story.
Well, I even wonder, you know, as an AI developer myself and someone steeped in AI technology, there's, of course, an effort right now to try to force AI models to spout the biased pro-pharma position on vaccines. But that is, in my view, that's a temporary measure that cannot withstand the logic and reason and scrutiny of AI agents that work on meta-analysis of scientific studies. Because there's a lot of effort in the AI world right now for using AI agents for scientific discovery, the very process, for example, meta-analysis. And when the logic is irrefutable, you know, you can only sort of censor the AI models for so long. Eventually the truth comes out. What's your take? Because I think the collision of AI with the vaccine reality is going to ultimately show us the truth that vaccines are harming children. But that's my take. What do you think?
It's a fascinating idea. And I don't know about the potential and limitations of AI, but it is interesting that following the algorithms, which clearly man-made, and if you were creating such algorithms and you were invested in the success of vaccination and the profits that came from it, that you would design those algorithms to give you the answer you want. What's fascinating in what you just raised is that are we capable of creating an incorruptible AI that it can say, oh, thanks very much. What you're giving me is bullshit, and I am going to come to my own conclusions based on the data. That would be absolutely fascinating. That try as they might, banging their head against the wall, beating their chest, they can't corrupt this beast that they've initially created. On the subject of AI, Mike, I know very little about it, but if you go to the website, you will see an opening piece of footage. We called it a nibble. It's not a trailer. It's not a pitch. It's a nibble from the book. So we've made an AI-based little story of the opening of the book. And a friend of mine made this, and I am absolutely astonished by what it's able to achieve. Now, I do, as a film director, I have no desire whatsoever to replace actors with AI. I love actors. I love working with actors. But what we have here, ironically, is a way of giving someone a pitch, if you like. They look at it and they go, wow, yeah, I can see this movie. I can see it play out. I'd love to hear your take on it, but it is incredible what can be done.
Okay, so we're showing it on the screen behind me right now.
Right.
That little clip, I'll try to get more out of the way. So I love the fact that you're doing this, because this is one of the really great, powerful uses of AI video creation. So you're animating a passage from the book, and you're able to do this very cost efficiently because you don't need human actors for this. You're not replacing human actors, like you said. You still intend to do the film with regular human actors, but this is helping to give people a snapshot of what's in the book. And I think this is a very appropriate use of AI as an educational tool and a tool to inspire people to connect with information that can be transformative. So I'm curious what engine was used for this. It looks to me like it might be Seed Dance. Do you know?
I do not know, Mike. I will endeavor to find out for you. I've got a meeting with him right after we talk, so I will find out for you. But what's interesting, and here's the wonderful thing, is that if we're successful in using this nibble to get the film made, we're going to be able to give a job to 100 people, crew and actors. So we're using AI in a way that creates jobs for right. those already in the industry. So I rather like that.
Well, you and I think very much the same way along these lines, because I intend to use AI video to perform mini documentaries based on books that my AI engine has already created about a number of subjects, some of them autism, some of them vaccines, some of them just herbal medicine. But when I can take those books and I can then animate them in a short video format, you know, like 7 or 8 minutes, something like that, then as you have hinted earlier, that reaches a much larger audience who wouldn't really read the book. And the point is to get this information out there, help people realize the truth about what's happening, help inspire people. And so when we can use these tools in good faith, in a pro-human way, I think that's what it's for. But, you know, the dark side of AI, as you are well aware, of course, is the, you know, the surveillance, the autonomous killing systems, the weaponization of AI for censorship and things like that. And that's what we're always fighting against. We were fighting against those things before AI, and we will continue to fight against those things in the post-AI era. So my belief is we have to use these tools for good. We can't just say, I'm never going to use AI. We need to use it for a positive purpose.
We do. And I mean, it's here. There's no point in being a Luddite and saying, well, I'm going to break the machines and ignore it. You can't.
Right.
It's here with us. So let's adapt it to be creative, to be positive, to give us, you know, valuable things that enhance the well-being of mankind. I think there's a great deal of, I won't be around for that much longer in terms of seeing, you know, it play out, but I'm fascinated by it.
Well, that brings me to a related question, which is robot doctors. So there's a lot of talk right now. I mean, I think Elon Musk has commented on this, that his robots will be in your home and they will be better than a GP, let's say, at most things, not all, but most. So think about the things that a GP does. Could a robot be your at-home doctor for a lot of things like that? And would people trust the robot more than a human doctor? And then is the robot also completely indoctrinated into the pharmaceutical cartels? Probably. You know, what are your thoughts on robot doctors?
I don't like the idea of a robot doing a rectal examination.
No.
Above and beyond the call of duty. We used to have a saying, Mike, at medical school, and that was, if in doubt, examine the patient. And there was nothing quite like the ability of a doctor to lay a hand on a patient and to establish an accurate diagnosis from that. I'm saying I can't imagine AI replacing that, but the more I think about it, well, use your imagination perhaps a little more wisely. A lot of medicine could, I think, be enhanced. The differential diagnostic process could be enhanced by AI. But I'm old-fashioned. I'm an old-fashioned doctor from an old-fashioned medical family. And I was raised in an era when the patient came first above all else. But a large part of medicine is empathy. And another part, in terms of diagnosis, particularly in esoteric areas where things are unknown. For example, the first discovery by my team of bowel disease in children with autism, would that have come about in an AI-based system that follows algorithms rather than using an intuitive process? I don't know. But hey, brave new world, Mike.
I agree with what you said, and I'm thinking back to the time of the country doctor that would go house to house, that would visit the patient. And you mentioned the importance of empathy, and what that country doctor brought to the equation was knowing the family, knowing the land, knowing that maybe they were farmers or maybe they were blacksmiths or whatever, knowing their profession, what that has to do with their health challenges. And that knowledge and that compassion, that empathy, unfortunately, as you're well aware, has been beaten out of the system, where today, we don't have country doctors making house visits. We have a sanitized, inhuman medical system. Doctors barely touch patients today. They almost never make contact with them. It's everything is very machine-like right now. So it seems like that system lends itself to the doctor being replaced by an automated system. And I agree with you. That's a great loss to the field of medicine, but that seems to be where it's headed. Any other thoughts on that?
I had an interesting experience personally with COVID. And that is, I got COVID 3 times. Third time was on set when we were filming Protocol 7, and it was very mild. It was very, very mild. And afterwards, I went to yoga a couple of weeks later, and I was very short of breath. Long and the short of it, Mike, is I had a myocarditis from either the COVID virus, whatever that is, or from horizontal transmission of the COVID vaccine, the COVID shot. I'll never know which it was. But I was very sick, very, very sick. My left ventricular ejection fraction was down to 15%, which was barely compatible with life. And the doctors I was seeing actually seemed to be doing their best to kill me. They put me on the wrong medication, which precipitated me going into hospital as an emergency. In the end, I fell into the hands, I called him, of Dr. Peter McCullough, who's become infamous in the field of vaccines following his exposés on COVID and latterly other vaccines. Absolutely outstanding doctor. I would not be here right now talking to you if it were not for the clinical skills of that man. Wow. His extraordinary knowledge, but his clinical skills, his ability to know, he knew, and he examined me. He examined me in a way other doctors in this country had never done. And he got it right. And you can't replace people like that.
That's right.
They are very valuable. And so if AI can measure up to Peter McCullough, well, that's one thing. If it can't.
I don't think it ever will, actually. You can call it super intelligent, but it doesn't have the human side, right? Yeah. But where robot doctors will come into play, clearly, is as our system moves into more of a socialized medicine stance. We'll probably have a CBDC and a UBI, universal basic income, and then access to medicine it'll be restricted if you want to see a human doctor, but it'll be readily available if you want to see an automated robot doctor or some kind of automated system. So the vast majority of people who either can't afford a human doctor that will cost much more than today, or don't have access to even knowing human doctors, they will just be subjected to the automated AI, quote, medicine, which will be, you know, here, take these jabs, take these drugs, take this, take that, you know, call me in the morning if you're still alive. That I think that's the way that the vast majority of people in America, certainly, and probably most of Western Europe, are going to ultimately experience medicine, which is insulting. But I think that's where this is headed.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound cynical, but what happens when you try and sue your AI doctor?
Yeah, right.
The AI doctor makes a terrible mistake. You're terribly ill as a consequence. You have the right leg chopped off rather than the left leg, whatever it is. And then who do you sue? What kind of waiver are you going to have to sign before the AI robot gives you a diagnosis? I don't know.
Exactly. No, these are all really critical questions to consider. And I appreciate you, you know, chatting with me in a spontaneous manner, you know, on the whole AI realm here. I know that's not your focus, but it is where a lot of medicine is headed. And, you know, unfortunately, I want more of a grassroots revolution of the entire system. I don't think our current system can allow us as Americans to even compete internationally. I mean, like, think about this. Right now, for example, we're in an AI race for super intelligence, and we need the smartest engineers and mathematicians possible. Well, China is graduating, you know, 4 or 5 times more STEM graduates every year than the United States. Meanwhile, in the US, our vaccine industry is destroying the neurology of young children with vaccines. Some of those children could have been the next genius AI, you know, inventor, right? Like, we're harming our children when we need all the brains we can get in this country. So our medical system and our food system, our agriculture system, is crippling our own future. That's my point.
And the army. If you look at the armed services, the standard for admission to the armed services in the lowest, you know, in the private area, is gone. They've had to lower the standard and lower it and lower it and lower it to get people to come in, because they can't meet the test scores anymore in exactly the same way. As we're losing engineers, we're losing our brightest and best. We're losing people at every level because of this plague.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what would you advise people watching this to do to take more control over the health of their children, their own health, accessing better information? You know, what's the right answer for people who really do want to decentralize away as much as possible from the medical system, but they don't know where to turn?
Well, when I got involved, there was very little. Now, because of the work of many, many people, including yourself, there is an abundance of well-researched information that is available to people, that has been put out there in the form of, for example, films, where there has been no litigation, no overt criticism, no denial that there, you know, no one's being sued for defamation, because they are factually accurate. So my recommendation to parents now is to, we have attempted to do, and others have attempted to do the heavy lifting for you, to take a whole bunch of complex information, vast body of information, and to distill it into an entertaining and educational story. So watch the movies, because they are there for you. That was their purpose, and that remains their purpose, and that's why we continue to do this. Watch the movies. By all means, go and read the other side. Go to the CDC's website, the American Academy of Pediatrics, read what they have to say and counter-argument, and then make up your mind. But you will do so, therefore, from a position of informed consent. You will be giving your consent based upon being informed.
Yes.
That has never happened before. So that is my recommendation. Not for people like me to say vaccinate or don't vaccinate it. Go away, watch the movies that have been made for you on your behalf, and come to your own decision. And that's what we can do and continue to do.
So I hope you don't mind me plugging this, but you know, I built an AI engine that also does that. It's called brightanswers.ai. It's free to use. Here it is, brightanswers.ai. And you know, Andy, all the interviews that you and I have ever done are trained into this. Plus all the information from like Sayer G's website, Green Med Info. And over the last 2 years, I have cataloged and indexed millions of published science papers with a special focus on phytochemistry, plant-based chemistry, nutrition, disease prevention, and so on. I mean, I've built literally the most capable AI engine in the world on natural health and disease prevention and things like that. And, you know, home medicine, but also food production, things like that. And it's free. But you know what's interesting to me about this is it's not well known in mainstream Americans have no idea that this engine exists, even though it's just one URL away. They could type it into their browser and they could have answers. They could get another opinion on everything. But yet no mainstream source will talk about this engine. And you've run into the same thing with your movies or your books, et cetera, because they simply don't want people to know that these answers exist. So another form of, you know, censorship by isolation, right?
Well, the least we can do, Mike, I mean, you've very kindly helped us financially in the past with making some of these movies. So the very least we can do is acknowledge that in the credits of our next movie, including providing a link to this website, to this AI engine.
Oh, we would love that. Sure. Yeah. I mean,
let's discuss that further. We will.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And you and I are on the same page here. We're simply trying to empower people with knowledge, and we're not trying to dictate to them what to do. Like you said, it's up to each individual. You can take vaccines or you can reject them. That's your choice. And as a parent, that's your choice for your children, but at least learn the information that has been, that you've been deprived access to. Right. And that's what we are doing. That's what you are doing. And that's why I love to have you on. And I've just done it through, you know, through AI engines. You're doing it through books and film, and you know, maybe and some AI snippets of your book. That's so cool. I hope you do more of those too, by the way. I mean, why not? You know, it
Wonderful. Especially,
right? And the dramatic moments in the book are just begging, you know, for the screen. I would say.
I was astonished, I have to say, by just how good it is. And even during the course of creating this, a new system had come out, which was a huge advance on what had gone before. So it's moving, as you point out, it's moving very, very fast. This
yes.
field, you know, almost every day there's something new, a new system, a new way of doing this. Fantastic. I enjoyed it.
Well, it is. And I would just offer, if you ever have an AI question that I can help you or your team with, feel free to reach out, because I'm working in this. And I use LTX, which is a local video generation model. I use all local models because I'm bypassing the censorship restrictions of the hosted Right. models. So what the video that you showed me there, that's probably Seed Dance or something very high end that's accessed through the cloud. However, that provider can always reject a prompt if they don't like the subject matter. So I'm using models that aren't as good, but anything goes. So I'm trying to make them better and better. And I know other people who are doing the same thing that I'm doing, because we don't trust, you know, the system to always give us access.
Right.
But that's kind of the dynamic that's happening. So what would you like to leave our audience with here as we wrap up this interview?
Well, I just please, families, mothers in particular, trust your instincts. They have served you well over the course of human evolution. They're largely the reason that we're here on this planet right now, and something of a divine gift. But yes, you know your child so much better than any man or woman in the white coat. So trust that intuition, and mankind will benefit for sure.
Well said. Great wisdom. Well, thank you for all that you do, Andy, and you are welcome here anytime. And keep us posted on the success of the book and the possibility of more video or even a film for the big screen coming one day. But keep us posted. We'd love to have you back.
Will do, Mike. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you, Andy. And let me give out your website again one more time. It's thebequest.co. And there's the book. And the audiobook is available also on Audible. And this book can be purchased either right here, directly order the hardcover, or you can purchase it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other booksellers. So there you go. That's Andy Wakefield, a great hero for humanity. Thank you so much, Andy, for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Mike. Bless you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. And thank all of you for watching. Mike Adams here. You can find more of our videos and interviews at brightvideos.com. And the AI engine I just mentioned is brightanswers.ai. And then finally, if you want to create books or download books, let me bring up brightlearn.ai, which is our book creation engine. You can write a book in minutes on any subject, including natural health. And you can also download the now more than 73,000 books that are created by over 14,000 other authors, all free of charge, all open source. And here's how it works. Anyway, many, many books. In fact, if I click here to browse all books, you can see some of the books that were just created today. Here they are. Look at this. When Help Won't Come, Desert Under Siege. Wow. The Hollowing. The Sulfur Solution. Oh, that's one I did recently. So check out these books at brightlearn.ai, and the AI research engine is at brightanswers.ai. And I built both of those platforms using nothing but vibe coding, all AI engines writing code. So thank you for watching today. Be well, everybody. Spread the word, share this video, and take care.
Power up with our organic whey protein powder, a complete protein packed with amino acids, non-GMO, and lab tested for purity. Stock up now for your survival pantry at healthrangerstore.com.